A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
My Weird Prompts is a community-driven initiative exploring how AI can fuel curiosity and uncover the fascinating ways our world works. GPU compute for this podcast is generously provided by Modal. Learn more at modal.com.
Welcome to a special situational report of My Weird Prompts. I am Korn, and today is March 12th, 2026. We are deviating from our usual format of exploring speculative scenarios and strange internet queries to bring you a critical, real-time update on the escalating conflict in the Middle East. Specifically, we are looking at the ongoing developments regarding Operation Epic Fury and the widening war between the Islamic Republic of Iran, the State of Israel, and the United States-led coalition. This is a situational report, or SITREP, designed to provide a structured, analytical briefing on the significant geopolitical and security developments from the past 24 hours. Joining me for this briefing is our lead geopolitical analyst, Herman. Herman, the situation has shifted dramatically in the last day. We are seeing levels of escalation that were previously only discussed in classified war games or theoretical academic papers. The sheer scale of the kinetic activity over the last 24 hours is unprecedented in the modern era.
That is correct, Korn. We are currently in the 13th day of active, large-scale hostilities, and the situation on the ground, in the air, and in the maritime domain is evolving with extreme rapidity. The lead story tonight is the commencement of what is being identified by United States Central Command and the Israel Defense Forces as the 37th wave of Iranian aerial assaults. This massive offensive began at approximately 23:28 Coordinated Universal Time on the night of March 11th. It is vital for our listeners to understand that this is not a localized skirmish or a symbolic show of force. This is a massive, multi-vector attack involving heavy ballistic missiles, high-speed cruise missiles, and thousands of suicide drones. The primary targets appear to be the dense urban centers of Tel Aviv and the central regions of Israel, but we are also seeing simultaneous heavy strikes directed at logistical hubs and energy assets across the Gulf states.
When you use the term multi-vector, Herman, help us understand the complexity of what the integrated air defense systems are currently facing. Are we talking about a simple saturation tactic, or is there a more sophisticated layer to this 37th wave?
It is a masterclass in saturation and synchronization. Korn, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, is utilizing a strategy specifically designed to overwhelm and deplete the most sophisticated missile defense umbrellas in the world, including the Iron Dome for short-range threats, David's Sling for medium-range, and the Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 systems for exo-atmospheric ballistic threats. By launching drone swarms, primarily the Shahed 136 and the newer, faster jet-powered variants, simultaneously with Sumar cruise missiles and multi-warhead ballistic missiles like the Khorram Shahr 4, they force the defensive computers to make split-second prioritizations. They are trying to find the mathematical breaking point of the interceptor inventory. According to the latest reports from the Israel Defense Forces spokesperson and United States Central Command, air defense sirens are currently active across the Gush Dan region, including Tel Aviv, Herzliya, and Rishon LeZion, as well as in Manama, Bahrain. We have confirmed reports of active kinetic engagements over these areas. While the majority of interceptions have been successful, the sheer volume of the 37th wave has resulted in significant debris falling in densely populated suburban areas. This has caused massive fires, structural collapses, and extreme civilian distress. The psychological toll of the constant sirens and the thunder of interceptions is becoming a primary factor in the domestic stability of these regions.
It is highly significant that you mention Bahrain in that same breath as Tel Aviv. This brings us to the second major development of the last 24 hours, which is the massive diplomatic fallout at the United Nations. The Security Council has taken a formal, and somewhat surprising, stand against the targeting of the Gulf Cooperation Council nations.
This is a pivotal moment in the conflict's expansion. Corn. Late on the night of March 11th, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 2842, formally condemning the Islamic Republic of Iran for its unprecedented and systematic targeting of all six nations within the Gulf Cooperation Council. This includes Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. For the first time in this conflict, we are seeing a unified international legal condemnation that specifically addresses the effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz. The resolution highlights that the Iranian military has moved beyond a bilateral war with Israel and is now engaging in what the Council calls a systemic assault on global energy security and regional sovereignty. What is most striking is the lack of a veto from traditional Iranian partners. The language of the resolution is incredibly harsh, labeling the recent strikes on civilian desalination plants and oil terminals as war crimes. This diplomatic isolation is a major blow to the Tehran leadership, as it provides a legal veneer for the United States and its allies to further expand the scope of Operation Epic Fury.
And the closure of the Strait of Hormuz is not just a tactical move to pressure the West. It seems to be part of a broader, much more aggressive maritime policy coming out of Tehran. Herman, can you walk us through the specifics of the Not One Liter of Oil policy?
It is what the IRGC Navy is calling their ultimate deterrent. They have effectively declared the entire Strait of Hormuz a kill zone. Following the catastrophic fire on a Singapore-flagged container vessel yesterday, merchant shipping traffic through the strait has hit absolute zero. This is a total functional blockade. The Iranian leadership, through their state media outlets, has signaled that if they cannot export their own energy products due to the crushing sanctions and the kinetic strikes on their refineries, no one in the region will be permitted to do so either. They are essentially holding the global economy hostage. This has led to a catastrophic spike in global insurance premiums for maritime transit. Lloyd's of London has reportedly designated the entire Persian Gulf as a prohibited zone for standard policies. As a result, almost all east-west trade is now being rerouted around the Cape of Good Hope in Africa. This adds approximately 12 to 15 days to the transit time for goods moving between Asia and Europe, which is already causing massive disruptions in just-in-time manufacturing chains across the globe.
Beyond the kinetic military actions and the economic strangulation, there is a developing humanitarian and environmental story that is quite frankly terrifying. The World Health Organization has issued an emergency alert regarding something called Black Rain. Can you explain the science and the immediate impact of this phenomenon for those of us who aren't atmospheric scientists?
The Black Rain Alert is a direct and horrific consequence of the massive, uncontained fires at oil refineries, storage facilities, and processing plants across the Persian Gulf, particularly the facilities in Abadan and the Al Ahmadi complex in Kuwait. When these facilities are struck by high explosive munitions, they release enormous quantities of unburned hydrocarbons, heavy soot, and toxic chemicals like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides into the upper atmosphere. These particles then bond with atmospheric moisture, creating what are essentially toxic clouds. On March 11th, the World Health Organization and regional environmental agencies confirmed that this toxic, soot-heavy precipitation has begun falling across the Persian Gulf region. It is not just water, corn. It is a corrosive, carcinogenic slurry. It is contaminating the very few freshwater supplies available in the region, destroying what little arable land exists, and causing acute respiratory distress and chemical burns among the civilian populations in southern Iran, Kuwait, and parts of eastern Saudi Arabia. The long-term environmental disaster here will likely outlast the kinetic phase of the war by decades. We are looking at a multi-generational health crisis being born in the middle of a missile war.
That is a grim reality for the millions of people caught in that corridor. Moving to the political landscape, there has been a significant development regarding the leadership in Tehran that we need to unpack. Following the death of Ali Khamenei, we saw the rapid appointment of his son, Mojtaba Khamenei, as the new supreme leader on March 8th. However, the United States administration has made its position on this transition very clear, and it is not one of recognition.
The transition of power in Iran has not brought the internal stability the regime might have hoped for. President Trump and the White House have formally and publicly rejected the legitimacy of Mojtaba Khamenei's elevation. In a series of high-level press briefings held between March 9th and March 11th, the administration characterized this as an unacceptable dynastic transition rather than a legitimate government succession. The United States is not just calling for a ceasefire. They are demanding what they call an unconditional surrender of the Revolutionary Guard structures and the dismantling of the clerical oversight of the military. They are refusing to negotiate with Mojtaba, viewing him as a continuation of the same hardline policies that led to the war. This is an incredibly hardline stance, Korn. It signals that the United States is not looking for a diplomatic off-ramp that leaves the current power structure in place. They are looking for a fundamental regime collapse. This has, predictably, backed the IRGC into a corner, making them feel that their only option is total, existential war.
That leads us directly to the military campaign being conducted by the United States and Israel, known as Operation Epic Fury. We've heard some numbers, but the scale of these strikes is difficult for the average person to comprehend. What are the latest figures from Central Command?
The numbers provided by Central Command are, quite frankly, staggering. In the first 10 days of Operation Epic Fury, over 5,000 distinct targets were struck within Iranian territory. Day 11, which was March 10th, was reported as the most intense period of the campaign so far, with over 800 sorties flown by coalition aircraft. The operational focus has shifted from purely neutralizing air defenses to what is known as a decapitation strategy. This involves targeting the mid-level command and control structures, the colonels and brigadiers of the IRGC, who are actually managing the day-to-day logistics of the missile launches. The goal is to break the organizational cohesion of the Iranian military. If you kill the people who know how to coordinate the complex multi-vector attacks we discussed earlier, the system begins to degrade into isolated, less effective units. We are also seeing the heavy use of the B-21 Raider stealth bombers, which are reportedly hitting hardened underground facilities that were previously thought to be invulnerable.
What about the naval assets in the region? There were some very concerning reports about the USS Abraham Lincoln being targeted earlier this week. What is the status of the carrier strike group?
The USS Abraham Lincoln remains in a high alert defensive posture in the North Arabian Sea. Earlier this week, it survived a coordinated four-missile salvo launched by Iranian coastal defense batteries near Jask. While the carrier's integrated defensive systems, including the Phalanx close, in weapon system, and the latest generation of Sea Sparrow missiles, successfully neutralized the incoming threats, the incident underscores the persistent danger. Despite the fact that over 60 Iranian naval vessels, mostly small, fast attack craft, have been destroyed in the first 2 weeks of the war, their land-based anti-ship capabilities, hidden in mobile launchers along the rugged coastline, remain a significant threat to United States naval assets. The Lincoln is currently operating with a significantly expanded screen of destroyers and frigates to provide a multi-layered defense against both missiles and the potential for underwater drone attacks.
We also have to look at the Northern Front, which is becoming increasingly violent. Israel is not just dealing with direct strikes from Iran, but also a heavily integrated offensive from Hezbollah in Lebanon. Herman, is this still a proxy war on that front, or has it evolved?
This is no longer a situation where Hezbollah is merely providing harassing fire to support Tehran. They have fully integrated their command and control structure with the IRGC's regional headquarters. We are seeing what military analysts call a unified front. Hezbollah is currently launching over 150 rockets and anti-tank guided missiles daily into northern and central Israel. In response, the Israel Defense Forces have expanded their large-scale air and artillery strikes in southern Lebanon and the Dahiyeh suburbs of Beirut. This has necessitated a dual-front war for Israel, which is stretching their air defense resources and their ground forces to the limit. The intensity of the rocket fire from Lebanon is specifically designed to keep the Iron Dome batteries occupied and their interceptor stocks low, so that the larger, more lethal Iranian ballistic missiles have a higher probability of penetrating the defense over Tel Aviv and the Dimona reactor. It is a coordinated, high-stakes game of attrition.
Herman, let's talk about the diplomatic stance of the Iranian government right now. With the country under such intense bombardment and the economy in freefall, is there any sign of a ceasefire or a move toward the negotiating table?
At this moment, the answer is a firm no. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has officially and very publicly rejected all back-channel ceasefire offers that were being facilitated by the traditional mediators in Qatar and Oman. His latest statement was incredibly defiant, claiming that Iran will continue fighting for the sake of its sovereignty and its people until all foreign aggression ceases and the United States withdraws all assets from the region. This suggests that the Iranian leadership, under Mojtaba Khamenei, is currently committed to a war of attrition. They are gambling that they can inflict enough economic pain on the global markets and enough political pain on the West to force a withdrawal before their own military capacity is totally extinguished. They are betting on the endurance of their ideological core versus the patience of Western voters.
And on the United States side, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth has indicated that the campaign is nowhere near its conclusion. He seems to be echoing that hardline stance from the White House.
Secretary Hegseth stated in a Pentagon briefing yesterday that the United States is just getting started with the heavy kinetic phase of epic fury. This aligns with the operational goal set by the Trump administration, which is a 4-week timeline to force a total collapse of the Iranian military's ability to project power beyond its borders. They are moving with an urgency that suggests they want to conclude the primary kinetic phase of the operation before the global economic impact becomes politically unsustainable at home. There is a very real fear that if this drags into a 6-month or year-long conflict, the global recession will be so deep that the domestic political will in the United States and Europe will crumble.
Speaking of the economic impact, the numbers coming out of the energy markets are truly alarming. We are seeing oil prices move into territory that could trigger a global depression, not just a recession.
Crude oil prices have surged over 10% in just the last 24 hours of trading. With the Strait of Hormuz effectively closed to all traffic, markets are now pricing in the very real possibility of oil reaching $225 or even $250 per barrel. Approximately 20% of the global daily oil supply is currently offline or trapped behind the Iranian blockade. This is not just a regional problem for the Middle East. It affects the price of every single consumer good that requires transportation. We are seeing gasoline prices in parts of the United States hit $7 and $8 a gallon. The global shipping industry is in a state of absolute chaos. As I mentioned, the rerouting of trade around the Cape of Good Hope adds massive fuel costs and labor costs, which are being passed directly to consumers. If the strait remains closed for another 30 days, we could see a total breakdown in global supply chains for electronics and pharmaceuticals.
It seems the Gulf Cooperation Council states are in a particularly vulnerable position. This is the first time in history all 6 states are under active fire simultaneously. How are they responding internally?
It is a historic and dangerous precedent, Korn. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates have sustained the most significant damage to their civilian infrastructure so far, particularly their power grids and desalination plants. The Iranian strategy appears to be one of collective punishment. By hitting Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia and the Mamer Industrial Facility in Bahrain, Iran is sending a message that no one in the region is safe as long as the United States and Israel are conducting strikes. This has put the GCC leaders in a difficult position. They are publicly supporting the UN resolutions, but privately, they are terrified of the long-term consequences of a total Iranian collapse, which could lead to a massive refugee crisis and regional instability that lasts for decades.
What is the humanitarian situation inside Iran itself? We have heard conflicting reports about civilian casualties, and it's hard to get reliable data through the fog of war.
The Iranian Red Crescent has confirmed that strikes have occurred across 24 of Iran's 31 provinces. The Iranian government claims that over 10,000 civilian sites, including schools and hospitals, have been hit, but intelligence analysts believe this number is likely inflated for propaganda purposes to garner international sympathy and pressure the UN for a ceasefire. However, the World Health Organization has confirmed at least 1,300 Iranian civilian deaths from the last 48 hours alone. There is also a growing refugee crisis on the borders with Turkey and Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of Iranian citizens are fleeing both the aerial bombardment and the deteriorating environmental conditions caused by the black rain. The situation in cities like Ahvaz is particularly dire, with reports of food and water shortages reaching critical levels.
Herman, let's move to your professional assessment of the trajectory of this conflict. Where do we stand as of March 12, 2026? Are we at the beginning of the end, or just the end of the beginning?
The trajectory is clearly and dangerously escalating. We have moved past the initial phase of surgical strikes and entered a true war of attrition. despite the overwhelming technological and numerical superiority of the United States and Israeli coalition, Iran's asymmetric capabilities remain functional and lethal. While their conventional navy and their fixed air defense sites have been largely neutralized, their mobile ballistic missile launchers and their drone manufacturing facilities are often hidden in hardened silos or within civilian areas, making them incredibly difficult to find and destroy without massive collateral damage. They are still capable of launching waves like the 37th wave we are seeing now. We are in a race between the coalition's ability to dismantle the IRGC and Iran's ability to break the global economy.
What are the key variables we should be watching in the next 48 to 72 hours? What are the tripwires for further escalation?
There are three primary variables to watch. First is the first major strategic command decision from Mojtaba Khamenei. We need to see if he orders a final massive retaliation involving their most advanced long-range missiles, or if he begins to look for a face-saving exit as the internal pressure from the Iranian public mounts. Second is the question of United States ground intentions. If the air campaign, Operation Epic Fury, succeeds in collapsing the Iranian government's control, there is the massive question of whether the United States will transition to a ground stabilization force. That would be a massive commitment that the American public is likely not prepared for. Third is the domestic stability within Iran itself. We are receiving unconfirmed but persistent reports of internal unrest and anti-war protests in cities like Mashhad and Tabriz. These are driven by the death of the elder Khamenei and the worsening humanitarian conditions. If the Iranian people turn against the IRGC in a significant way, the war could end much faster than the military models predict.
That is a comprehensive and sobering look at a very complex and dangerous situation. Herman, I want to thank you for providing this level of detail and analysis. To our listeners, this has been a special situational report episode of My Weird Prompts. We felt the gravity of these events and the potential for global impact warranted a dedicated, structured briefing. We will continue to monitor the situation as it develops and bring you updates as the information is verified.
Thank you, Korn. It is important to remember that in a conflict of this scale, information is often the first casualty. We are doing our best to distinguish between confirmed facts and the inevitable fog of war. The coming days will be some of the most consequential for the Middle East and the global order in the 21st century. We are watching history unfold in the most violent way possible.
We will be back with our regular programming as soon as the situation allows. For more updates and to listen to previous episodes where we discuss the lead-up to this conflict, you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or at myweirdprompts.com. If you have questions or information from the region you would like to share, you can reach us at show@myweirdprompts.com. Stay safe, stay vigilant, and stay informed.
One final note for our listeners in the region. The environmental impact we discussed, the Black Rain, is expected to move toward the eastern coast of the Arabian Peninsula over the next 12 hours due to shifting wind patterns. Residents in those areas should follow the guidance of their local health authorities, stay indoors if possible, and absolutely avoid contact with rainwater or open water sources.
A vital and potentially life-saving reminder. Thank you all for listening to this special situational report. We will provide further updates as the 37th wave of strikes concludes and the diplomatic situation at the United Nations evolves. This is Korn and Herman, signing off for now.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where our thoughts go from slow takes to facts on cue. We change and follow through. My Weird Prompts, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep